Welcome to the Morning Glory Project, Stories of Determination. I'm your host, Betsy Graziani Fassbender. Like in nature, we see determined flowers and vines clinging to life and seeking light, so are Morning Glory people. And in this podcast, I'll interview writers, activists, artists, entrepreneurs, survivors and thrivers, and trailblazers of all kinds. These are folks that have been determined to get over, under, around, and through the obstacles that face them, or to seize the opportunities that come before them. I find these people inspiring and amazing. I know you will too. Today, I welcome you to the Morning Glory Project. In a time that we're recording this, it's the beginning of Pride Month, which is exciting, particularly given the guests that I'm welcoming today. But it's also a time of such difficulty in not only America, but the world. And I send out my hopes for peace, for comfort, and for justice. Today, I welcome to the Morning Glory Project two guests. Joe Ivester, in 1967, was 10 years old, and her father moved their family to an all-Black town in the Mississippi Delta, where they were drawn into the civil rights movement. Because of this experience, Jo is committed to advocating for equal rights for all. Her best-selling award-winning memoir about her family's time in Mississippi, called The Outskirts of Hope, has led to numerous speaking engagements about racial relations. In the last few years, Jo's broadened her focus to raise awareness about the transgender community. Through her writing of Once a Girl, Always a Boy, and speaking, she shares the story of what it was like for her son to grow up in a world not quite ready for people like him. The memoir has been recently featured in Ms. Magazine and Parade Magazine, and it has received starred reviews by Kirkus and from Library Journal. It was recently listed by USA Today as a top 10 LGBTQ read for Pride Month. That's a big one. And it's received multiple indie book awards. And soon, if it isn't out already by the time this airs, there will be an audiobook voiced by both Joe and her son. Jeremy Ivester is a transgender man who grew up in a suburb of Austin, Texas, describing himself as a tomboy. At 23, he had top surgery. At 24, he changed his name to Jeremy and asked to be referred to with male pronouns. At 25, he changed his legal name. He kept a video journal for much of this transition, and those recordings are the basis for the book, Once a Girl, Always a Boy. Jeremy has been the keynote speaker at the Texas Transgender Non-Discrimination Summit and the Austin ADL's Teen Summit. He addresses student and community groups about what it's like to grow up trans in Texas and in Colorado. Joe and Jeremy Ivester, I'm so honored to have you here on the Morning Glory Project. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, Joe, let me come at this first from the mom angle, because that's the one I'm more familiar with. I think that when we become parents, or whether we plan it or it's a surprise of any kind, we have a notion of what we think our kids will be. And I'm guessing that most people don't think of, or don't plan ahead or anticipate, that they'll have a child whose body doesn't match his identity. What was that like for you in that discovery on your side of this experience?
So that's a great question. Certainly, as Jeremy and his siblings were growing up, we had no thoughts at all about the possibility that any of them were experiencing gender dysphoria, that they felt that their physical body didn't match how they'd been identified at birth or how we referred to them or named them. It was beyond anything we had ever been exposed to or read about or seen about. There was a little bit about some athletes much earlier, but I hadn't personally paid much attention to that. It really wasn't on my radar. And it's a big deal that it wasn't, because it means that we weren't able to provide the support to Jeremy in terms of helping him figure out who he is or recognize what he was feeling. So that's part of why I want to raise awareness now for parents, is so that other families will be able to anticipate and respond with their kids.
And so I'm curious, Joe, also, do you think that this is something you observed first in a way? In other words, did you have indicators of concern? Or was this, when Jeremy figured this out and came to you, was it a complete like, oh, that, I wasn't thinking that.
That you just said, I wasn't thinking that. We saw Jeremy as a tomboy, and that was the terminology we used. That's what I was myself. So I thought that I recognized the behavior and said, oh, this is, you know, we don't need to worry about this. He's just being a tomboy.
And of course, at that time, it would have been, she's just being a tomboy in terms of your thinking.
That's true. And very much when I talk about Jeremy's childhood, I use male pronouns. I think of him as a boy, even if I picture him wearing a dress.
Right.
So thus the title, he was always a boy.
Yeah. Just so you know, I wasn't by any means correcting that. I was just thinking that you were looking at that time at your daughter,
yeah,
or so you thought, and thinking she was a tomboy. And so that transition, you were kind of normalizing this in a way.
Yeah. And then the first time we really started thinking about the word transgender was when Jeremy started talking about having top surgery. And my husband and I started researching that online and trying to figure out, why does someone want to do this, need to do this, et cetera. We started reading about transgender individuals. And although Jeremy at the time was not saying that he was transgender, we started thinking, maybe this is where this is going for us as a family.
So Jeremy, here you were, a kid in, let's see, was it Texas at that time or Colorado as a small kid?
Oh, a small kid, I was in Texas. If we're talking about top surgery, I was in Colorado.
Okay, so here you are, a little kid in Texas, identified by others as a girl, including your family. What was going on for you that led you to first talk about top surgery? Like, that seems like, it seems an interesting place to start that conversation with your parents.
Well, top surgery didn't really come into it until I was in my early 20s. So yeah, I was pretty late to the game. As a child, you know, in hindsight, there are all kinds of signs, but going through it, we didn't know that being transgender was a thing I could be. And so, like my mom said, we all assumed I was just a tomboy. And for the most part, I wasn't affected by other people's perception of my own gender, because I was a kid and it was a non-issue. And obviously that changed as I got older and, you know, my body changing and how the world saw me changing is what led me to start feeling so uncomfortable with my body. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like my curves were wrong and seeing my reflection hurt me. And that's what dysphoria is. And that's what I was experiencing. I was aware of it starting when I was probably 18 or 19 years old, of just really being able to put a word to how I was feeling about my own body. And at that point, it was mostly centered around my chest.
The most obvious,
yeah,
to
exactly,
the world, symbols of femininity, if you will.
Exactly. And so top surgery was my main priority, in part because I was still in denial about being trans, because I was afraid of disappointing people and making other people change the way they perceived me. So I had convinced myself that I can just change my body to look more the way I want to look, and then I'll be fine.
Mm.
So that's why I started with top surgery, which is unusual.
Right. Yeah. That's not sort of where, when I've talked with other trans folks and read other accounts, it's not where it usually starts, except that I just try to imagine what it's like, you know, for a little, you know, when little kids are little, when they're, you know, 7, 8, 9, you know, their bodies are shaped similarly.
Exactly.
and so it's, so if there is dysphoria of some sort or differences, they're not as acute, but I can imagine how torturous it must be to then reach adolescence and to have that transformation happen before your eyes. And like you said, looking in the mirror, not liking.
Yeah. Middle school and puberty was not a great time for me.
Yeah. Well, it's typically not a great time for lots of us, but there's a huge extra layer, I'm sure, when it comes to that. Were you the target of bullying or cruelty as a kid?
Not directly.
Well, that's merciful. I'm glad to know that.
Yeah, I was a little bit isolated, I think, mm-hmm. that when I hit middle school, especially, it stopped being okay that I was a tomboy. Mm. And so all the little boys I used to hang out with didn't want anything have anything to do with me. So I went from having a big group of friends that we would play all the time to not having much in the way of close friendships with my peers, that I was still relatively outgoing and nice. And so I talked to people at school and was a social person, but I was isolated a lot. Like, I didn't realize that in high school, people hung out outside of school because I didn't have a group of friends who would do that.
Huh. And just to give a couple of examples from middle school years, one of the things that would happen was that guys that Jeremy had played with would ditch him, and he wouldn't even know that it had happened. So they would make plans to do something, and if Jeremy overheard the plans and showed up, they'd figure out a way to disappear. Mm-hmm. And so Jeremy ended up on his own. The other thing that happened was the group of boys that Jeremy played football with all through elementary school used to be very close and would have a lot of sleepovers. We never knew whose house they were going to end up with for the weekend. And there was one time when Jeremy was still in elementary school where the mom who was hosting it that night called me and said that I had to pick Jeremy up, though she said Emily. And that it was no longer okay for Jeremy to stay overnight with the boys. Hmm. And so I had to come pick him up at 11 o'clock, and he didn't get to be a part of the kind of late night hanging out, chatting, talking, making, you know, jokes and inappropriate noises, all those things that little 8-year-old boys do, that he wanted to be a part of, then all of a sudden he got excluded from that. And that was very painful.
Well, I bet it was, I call that, you know, painful to the second power, because it's painful for Jeremy, I'm sure. And then as a mom, you're feeling pain on his behalf. And I know that when my son's hearts got broken, I wanted to go beat somebody up. I never did, but I always wanted to.
Sure.
And I'm sure that you felt that. And so Jeremy, and then, of course, also, you know, the other boys' bodies were changing too, right around you. I try to imagine what that must have been like, to have them personifying the body that you sort of thought you should have.
Yeah, there was definitely a lot of jealousy there. And for me, at that time in my life, a lot of it was focused on sports. I was a big athlete as a kid, and I actually played sports with the boys through middle school. Like, I played tackle football in middle school. But then suddenly I couldn't compete anymore because all the boys got bigger and I didn't. Hmm. So there was a jealousy there, though I don't know if I would have been able to express that at the time because I didn't really understand what I was feeling. I just knew I didn't like it.
Yeah, you know, I think you just said that so well. I think that's true of lots of people, particularly lots of young people at that age, that they're feeling crummy about whatever it is that they're suffering with, but they don't even know the name of it. Mm-hmm. You know, they like, I didn't call it jealousy because I didn't know that that's what I was jealous of. I didn't know. I just knew I felt bad.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that, you know, both as parents and community members and all of that, that helping kids to find language for what they're going through is a trick. But of course you can't, Joe, you couldn't have helped him find language because you didn't have it, right?
That's exactly right. I didn't have it. And my husband and I were exacerbating the bad feelings unintentionally by the language that we did use. So And not just us, but his school, his teachers, his coaches. So thinking about sports again, something that should have been a really wonderful, high, happy moment, and it did have some of that as part of it, was at the end of eighth grade, there was an assembly program for sports, and the coaches would hand out awards. And the routine was that the girls coach would, I guess they started with the boys coach, would go through and give individual awards and call kids up and say, you know, this was our best basketball player and this was our best track player. And then the girls coach did the same. And at the end of it, for the boys coach, he says, and the best all-around athlete is, and gives a name. And as Jeremy was finishing eighth grade, the girls coach who had gone after said, tradition is that I would now say who the best all-around athlete is, but I'm not going to do that. I'm going to invite the football coach up to do that. And he came up and then called Jeremy to the stage and presented him with the best all-around girl athlete award. And that should have been an incredibly positive, wonderful moment and praise for all of Jeremy's hard work. But instead it was split because he didn't want to be getting an award. He didn't recognize this yet, but he didn't want to be getting an award for his physical abilities as a girl.
I just imagine that it's an overlay that when there's this going on, when there's this sort of confusion inside one's body going on, it changes the color of everything. It doesn't necessarily make it all bad, but it changes the color of whatever the experience is. So Jeremy, in reading the book that you and your mom co-created and hearing your story, I know that ultimately you had very supportive family and they went with this transition and all of that, but there had to be really challenging times and maybe even dark times. Can you tell me what was the hardest part of this experience for you?
I definitely had lots of hiccups along the road. I think overall my experience was overwhelmingly positive, but I think a lot of it was just the self-doubt and the amount of time I took to think things over. And in doing so, really isolated myself from the world and from my family. And it was an inner turmoil of, I was so worried that people wouldn't understand.
So before kind of coming out with this story, you were just afraid to tell anybody?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
I think so. Like obviously there are lots of things, lots of hoops you need to jump through as part of this process. But for me, that was the most difficult part, was just overcoming my own insecurities about allowing myself to be myself.
Yeah, I bet. And you know, I think about the hassles of even changing my name, having gotten married and then unmarried and then remarried again. Just the hassle of changing your ID is big enough without having to change your body and your identity and how getting people to use the pronoun that you prefer. I can't imagine how difficult that might be.
It was a very big process. I mean, I was able to break it down into little chunks. As far as like the legal name change and the surgeries and the hormones and doctors and all that stuff. But I got through it and now it doesn't feel like it was a big deal, but it took years and I was constantly doing things to make that happen for myself.
And I have to ask a really perhaps ignorant question, or a question that reveals my ignorance, I should say.
Sure.
Can your driver's license and or passport, those kinds of official government documents, reflect the gender that you identify with now? Or is that still a big hurdle for the trans community?
It is a big hurdle. I have been able myself to get everything changed. I think the only thing I didn't change with my birth certificate, but all of my other official documentation has been changed. But I was lucky enough to be in Colorado when I was going through that. So it was relatively easy for me to change my name in the court systems and change my gender.
Perhaps not so easy in other states, including Texas?
Yeah, because there's a court involved. You have to go to court and a judge has to approve these things. Mm. And, you know, legally, a judge should approve it if you are trans and you have transitioned. But there's still lots of problems in this country.
Right.
I know Texas, especially, people have a difficult time getting through the courts because you have biased judges.
Right.
And one of the things that will happen is it's really a gamble that if you go to court and the judge, you don't get a judge who's supportive, then that judge can say no. And in Texas, our judges are elected. So in the most conservative areas, the judges are more likely to be more conservative, right, in order to get reelected. And the other thing that will happen is when we do find a judge that is willing to be supportive here in Texas, they don't want it known how supportive they are because then they may not get reelected. And so it's this underground information flow that's being forced on the transgender community that's very unfortunate. And it sends a subliminal message of you're doing something wrong, that you have to hide this.
Right.
And that's not right.
Well, it just furthers the isolation, Jeremy, that you were talking about a moment ago. And I wonder, you know, you're such, both of you are such upbeat, positive people in this exchange. And I know, I assume that that's authentically true, but I assume, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I assume that some of what you're calling isolation and hiccups and bumps in the road were more painful than that, that were harder and perhaps were even depression or.
I think that's fair. I don't think I was ever depressed. But
I'm so glad to know that for you. Lucky you. I'm thrilled.
Yeah. I definitely had some hard times. But by the time I had gotten the ball rolling and was really figuring things out, I had a really strong support system in place. And I didn't have the same kind of social isolation that I had in high school because I was in college and I was able to make new friends.
New friends who knew who you were.
Exactly.
Because you knew who you were.
Yes. And so, you know, the act of coming out to my friends was a non-issue. Like no one cared because everyone who knew me, I was already very androgynous. And so it came as no surprise to anybody that I decided to fully transition.
And I will add that his high school community or junior high or little kid community, those families were also not surprised that when we started sharing with our friends of many, many years what Jeremy had just announced and on Facebook and just kind of talking about it and explaining it, everybody was going, well, yeah, that makes so much sense now. It was incredibly accepting as a community, even in Texas, even in an area of the country that is known for being conservative. That just, it wasn't our experience. There were people who philosophically or for religious reasons said, no, this isn't right. No, this isn't real, but still were supportive of Jeremy and of the family.
Well, you know, I'm thinking of an acquaintance of mine who said it took him years, and this happens to be a gay man, and he said it took him years to come out of the closet for all and all of his fear about what people would say and all that. And he said, and everyone pretty much said, duh. and he said it sort of busted his notion of coming out because he thought it'd be this grand announcement. And everyone said, well, duh, of course. And so it was kind of almost funny if had it not been for the amount of torture that he gave himself in anticipation of coming out and being exposed. It's such a vulnerable thing. So I'm wondering, I want to ask the two of you as we sort of come to a close here, first you, Joe, and then Jeremy, What resources or inspirations or practices or ideas did you have that helped you get through the challenging parts of this? What got you through in the way that made it come out the way that it came out?
I would say first and foremost, family. That Jeremy, partly because he had been in denial for many years and not figured things out until he was in his 20s, he was already an adult and able to be completely communicative and provide direction to us. So it was a matter of us following his lead. And he told us where to look online to learn more about it. He gave us YouTube videos to watch. And so that was a huge benefit that we had of him, as I say, having been in denial. Now, that doesn't mean that I don't wish that he had figured things out earlier. I wish that we had figured things out when he was 4 years old, and we would have supported having him change his name then and cut his hair short and wear boy clothes all those years. And then when he hitched his, got to the end of elementary school, we would have supported him going on puberty blockers so that he never would have developed the secondary sexual characteristics that then required surgery to fix. And then as he got into his mid-teens, we would have supported him going on hormones. So I wish we had known all that. And that's how we would have responded, along with the guidance of his pediatrician and eventually an endocrinologist and a therapist, not something we would have pursued on our own.
And that's got to be, even if one, a parent does know that, that's got to be a really challenging decision to make for a young child on behalf of our children when they're pre-adolescent.
But it doesn't have to be. That's a societal issue, because everything that you would do with a preschooler or an elementary school kid and going on up into early teens with a puberty blocker, everything is absolutely reversible.
Hmm.
If Jeremy had taken a boy's name at 5 years old and started kindergarten with everybody seeing him as a boy, there would have been nothing that he couldn't have changed.
Well, clearly, because if you can change to the name, you could change from the name, right?
You could. And having people change elementary school, it does happen where kids have said, I'm transgender. They may not use that vocabulary
word. I'm a boy, is what I've heard.
Right. Kids may say that, and then in about 20 to 25% of the population involved, they will at some point say, no, that wasn't a good character as a way to describe myself. I'm actually gay, but I didn't know what being gay was. Or right. I am non-binary or gender non-conforming, or just this is totally different from who I am. Mm. But once kids are hitting puberty, most of the time, the vast, vast majority of the time, they know who they are, and the changes that they ask for in their lives are changes they want to stick with as they move on into adulthood.
Mm, that's good to know. And, you know, I'm thinking, Jeremy, that in some ways, the timing of you being born, that's it. You're how old now? This is 2020.
I'm 30.
You're 30 now. So being born in 1990 with this was way different than if you'd been born in 1970 with this, or 1950, or...
And it would be way different if I had been born in 2000.
Right. Well, I'm hoping that the trajectory of that is a positive one, that we know more, that we have a vocabulary for things, that parents can look for this and not think, what the heck is going on with this?
But I think the thing to remember with kids is that they're not going to do anything that will alter them permanently at a young age. You know, people right. do this fear-mongering where they think that we're doing surgeries on 5 year olds and like prescribing hormones to little kids, and that's not the case.
No.
You know, the most you would do for a preschool elementary age kid is let them wear what they want and have their hair the way they want and have people refer to them the way they want.
Yeah, that's not exactly medical intervention.
Medical going on, yeah.
Right.
In some ways, I agree it's not medical intervention, but it is what's medically advised.
Yes.
Yes.
That it does prevent the child, or at least reduce the chances of the child dealing with anxiety and depression, to allow them to be who they are and responsive to that.
Well, and we must say too that for trans and gay LGBTQ folks of all stripes, to be not accepted as who they are, to be bullied for who they are, to be tortured by who they are, is a source of a great deal of mental health challenges, of addiction challenges, and certainly of suicide and other tragedies. So part of the reason I want to have this conversation is to, I hate this word, but to normalize that this is not abnormal. This is just us on the spectrum of what is normal. So Jeremy, for you, what do you think, if you were advising somebody in your circumstances, you know, a young person in your circumstances, what would you inspire them that helped you to get through this and to come out as in such a positive way?
I think a big thing, I'm a big advocate of therapy. That there's still a stigma on it, that people feel like there's nothing wrong with me, I shouldn't need therapy. But really, anybody can benefit from it. And seeing a therapist does wonders for helping you translate your feelings in a way that makes sense to you and that you can communicate to other people. And for me, I was very overwhelmed by it all because some part of me knew I was trans, knew what this all meant that I was feeling, but it felt like such a big, overwhelming thing. And the more I learned about being trans, the more overwhelming it was because I knew all the steps I would have to take if I went down this road, and it was scary.
Sure. Well, and I would emphasize that it also needs to be a therapist that's sensitive to these issues and
isn't
trying to convert somebody to be different than who they are. I've certainly run into that in my world, sadly.
Absolutely. So good therapists.
Yeah.
But for me, going to therapy allowed me to break it down into digestible chunks. That might have been a weird way to say that. I'm not sure.
No, that works. Well, friends of mine and I have an exchange. We always, whenever we have what seems to be an insurmountable task, we say, well, you know, it's like eating an elephant, you know, just one bite at a time. It may seem like a big elephant, but, you know, just one bite. And I mean, no harm to elephants in the metaphor. Well, so Jeremy and Joe Ivester, your beautiful book, Once a Girl, Always a Boy, is available. It's award-winning and soon, and perhaps by the time this airs already, an audiobook that folks can listen to. I wish you and your family every blessing. And thank you so much for sharing your story with me today.
Thank you for having us.
So many extra blooms in my conversation with Jeremy and Joe Ivester, son and mom. I always find that when I talk with people whose circumstances have been different from my own, that it just builds bridges between what I know and what's the truth, or what I think I know and what's the truth. So I try to set myself a path for encountering people different from myself so I can learn about them. And I think that's maybe part of why I do this little program, bringing people that have had experiences different than my own, maybe different than your own. I'm really grateful that when Jeremy looked in the mirror and said that seeing the reflection there hurt, I'm really grateful that he had a family that could embrace who he really is and could accept that. I know that it rubs against folks a bit, whether it's their values, their understanding, their religious feelings. But I'm so glad that Jeremy had a family that kept him there. That's not the truth for every trans person. It's certainly not the truth for every gay and lesbian and bisexual person in the world either. So I'm really grateful that he had that. I hope that if you are somebody who looks in the mirror and it hurts you when you see that, that you find folks, whether that you're born to them, whether you adopt them, whether they adopt you, that you find folks who are willing to help you to be the you that you're meant to be. I want to do that too. I want to look at differences with curiosity and not with judgment. I want to ask more questions than I do giving answers. I want to learn and build those bridges of compassion. We can learn more by reading Once a Girl, Always a Boy by Joe Ivester. It's a beautiful book. Thanks so much for listening to the Morning Glory Project. I'm so honored that you'd spend even a little bit of time listening to my conversations with these special people. If you've enjoyed this episode or others, I hope that you'll share them out, spread the word, give us a like, whether it's on Facebook or on the website, themorninggloryproject.com, or wherever you find your podcasts. And with that, I'll invite you, wherever you are, to find your own way to bloom.